Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Classic Gaming Brothers. I'm Zach.
And I'm Seth.
And we are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right, we are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's right.
That's right.
What a day.
What a day, what a dollar.
What a day, wait, what a dollar.
Did I mess up?
No. Why?
You said, hey there everyone, this is Zach. I said, I'm Seth. You said, well, I said, I'm Zach, I'm Seth, and we are the Classic Gaming Brothers. That's right. We are the Classic Gaming Brothers. All right. Yeah, I think I got it right. All right.
Whatever.
I get messed up.
It happens.
It does happen, but not often.
That's right. I will say, I do know producer Doug is not a fan of lore episodes, so he's going to hate the next two episodes, but not this one. He'll love this
one.
Or
three episodes. Or four
or the next
episodes.
Three, yeah.
It's just all lore episodes from here on out.
Yeah, we're now the Classic Lore Brothers.
Just for producer Doug. He yelled at me.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. It was like a friendly yell.
Oh, he was like, hello, do you want to get wieners?
No, he said, I hate your guts and I need you to re-record all of these episodes. And then he threw a bunch of stacks of paper at me. Isn't that friendly?
Oh, is it the blank paper that he keeps on him at all times?
Yeah, this big blank stack of papers that he throws at people.
Yeah.
Anyway, Zach, what have you been recently been playing?
Seth, recently I've been playing the game Orcs and Elves.
Is that like Warcraft?
No. Orcs and Elves is an RPG game made by id Software back in 2006 for both mobile phones and ported to the Nintendo DS in 2007. It's actually based on the same engine that they used for the Doom RPG games, which is one of the reasons I wanted to play it, because I had just finished playing Doom 2 RPG a few episodes ago, and I was like, hey, I want to play a game like this, but in a different style. So I learned about Orcs and Elves, and I am playing that on my DS. It's the same type of gameplay in the sense that it is a first-person RPG. You can only move one square at a time. You can only look in four directions. The combat is grid-based, and battles are turn-based. Turn-based in the sense that you move, your enemy moves. You attack, your enemy attacks. Not turn-based in the sense of, like, Final Fantasy, where you have to traverse a menu and go through an Excel spreadsheet to find your spells. You play as an elf named Eli, who has come into possession of a wand called Elon, and the wand talks, and you don't talk. The wand just talks for you, I guess. And the wand also guides you through your journey. You're traversing through various caves and dungeons, and you encounter creatures like were-rats, slimes, orcs, as you can imagine from a game called Orcs and Elves, and other variety of monsters. Really, the game, I think, should be called Monsters and Elves, because there are a lot of monsters, not just orcs.
Maybe in this world, all the monsters are just called orcs.
Maybe. You fight them off with swords, crossbows, and the wand, which you can use to perform magic. Because it's a DS game, the way you cast the magic is you actually, on the bottom screen of your DS, you take a stylus and you tap the screen in a certain order, kind of like draw out a symbol, and that allows you to cast certain spells. There's different spells you learn. I've learned electricity and fire, and they use up energy, so you can only use them once, and then you have to wait for it to recharge. One thing I do like about the game is that the store you visit is a dragon, and the dragon's name is Gaia, and you have to barter with the dragon. And if you give Gaia bad deals, Gaia gets mad at you, and I don't know what happens if Gaia gets really mad at you, but I should do like a test save and find out. If you keep Gaia in a good mood, Gaia gives you better deals, so better prices, but you'll be like, oh, this potion is 10 gold. And instead of just saying bye, it will give you a slider and you can maybe offer Gaia 5 gold or you can offer Gaia 15 gold. And if you offer Gaia more gold, Gaia's like, I really like this deal. And if you offer Gaia less than 10 gold, usually Gaia will say, this deal is acceptable. Unless you give them a really bad deal and they're like, no.
But there's only one shop?
Yeah, but you go back to it. So there are portals to take you to the shop.
So like ultimately you want the shop person to be happy with you.
Yes, but there's not a ton of money in the world, so you do have to kind of balance your budget, so to speak. So, you know, if you make sure you're stocking up on the necessary equipment while also not making a giant dragon mad at you. But I do like the kind of lore element of a dragon being like a hoarder, and this dragon is kind of okay with you taking their stuff as long as you give them more things.
It should have been like a Yukon Trail where you got to pick your guide. Let's buy some folding bicycles.
They throw the bicycles off the ship because the guy's like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen.
Yukon Trail is the game where you don't take the banker.
Anyway, Orcs and Elves is a fun game. If anyone has a DS or a way to play DS games, I recommend trying it out.
Nice.
Seth, what about you? What have you been playing?
Recently, I have not been playing the Yukon Trail, though now that I'm talking about it, kind of do want to do a speed run. But I've recently been playing Scrap Garden, which was developed by Agudis Basher and Alexei Davidov. And I just butchered those names. And anyway, it was released back in 2016. It's a puzzle platformer about the adventures of Canny, who is a robot. And essentially what happens with Canny is, from my understanding, Canny is in trouble and is going towards like execution or something, and they're taking his batteries out. And when they take the battery out from him, the bombs drop on them and everyone is fried except for Canny, because his battery was removed. And then through just the way a happenstance happens, after hundreds of years, a battery just falls into Canny, and Canny is awake. So Canny is alive as a robot in the post-apocalyptic robot world. So kind of like Fallout, except it's a puzzle platformer. So nothing like Fallout. So you play as a little robot who runs around and jumps on things and needs to figure out puzzles in order to progress forward and climb buildings. It's a 3D isometric type of view where you have your character, kind of like Mario 64, where you have your character visible and you can control them. It's fun. It's a fun, like, Steam Deck type, on the couch, casual type of game. Yeah. And that's Scrap Garden, which was released back in 2016.
Nice. That sounds fun. Well, today we're actually going to be talking about a game that was a request from a fan. So this comes in from a listener named David, who commented on our Facebook page and said, you guys should talk about Kid Nicky. So that's exactly what we're doing. So David, this one's for you. And if you want to have an episode basically written for you, send us a comment or an email.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes we are we're very fast at getting an episode together. Sometimes we're very slow, and sometimes we will forget for years, and then we'll decide to do one and remind you that you requested it once. I'm thinking back to when Brandon requested Resident Evil 4, and we took forever to do that episode. But yeah, so if there's a request out there, or if you haven't heard from us and you want to hear from us, or if you thought you were going to hear from us and you didn't hear from us, you can always email us at classicgamingbrothers@gmail.com. And we're available on Twitter, Instagram, and
we're not ending the episode now.
Darn it.
To talk about Kid Nicky, Radical Ninja, we need to first talk about the company that gave us Kid Nicky, Radical Ninja. And that company is iRem. We've talked about iRem before, as they were involved in the production of quite a few games that we've previously covered, be they Retro Rewinds, Recently Plays, or just offhandedly mentioning about their games in previous episodes. I couldn't remember if we talked about their history, so let's just do that. If we've already done it, then we're doing it again. iRem got its start as a company founded by Tenzu Sugimoto in Asuka Prefecture, Japan. Originally, the company was intended to sell machines that produced cotton candy, but Sugimoto had been interested in expanding into the world of gaming. Pachinko and other types of games were starting to become big money makers in Japan, so he shifted his business to creating these machines. Sugimoto would become the founder of a company called IPM Co. Ltd. in 1974, with IPM standing for International Playing Machine. IPM would get their name out by being a resource for Japanese storefronts to install machines. So if you were a storefront and you wanted to have a pachinko machine, you contacted IPM and they brought your pachinko machine into the building and they installed it for you. And then they came and collected, because that's what a lot of times would happen. Like, I know for a fact that that's how jukeboxes were structured. So when a restaurant has a jukebox, just a fun little tangent, I learned this recently, very recently. When a restaurant has a jukebox, or had a jukebox, the restaurant did not own that jukebox. Another company owned that jukebox, and that company would come to collect. And a fun fact is, if the restaurant was very quiet and no one was playing any music, the restaurant owner would sometimes drop their own coins into the box to get it to play, but they wanted their coins back when the person came to collect, so sometimes they would paint their coins red, and those were called house coins. So sometimes coin collectors will have these like painted red coins. Those are old house coins from these places that ran jukeboxes. Anyway, Sugimoto felt that this whole method method of going into stores and installing these game machines was basically just what they were doing when they were selling cotton candy machines. So he was like, we are stepping in the right direction, but we gotta really take ourselves into the gaming world. And in 1976, there was kind of a breakthrough for them. The company Atari, thanks to the talents of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, put together Breakout, and that hit the arcade scene and became a smash hit. And it was being cloned by everyone. We actually talked about how Sunsoft, they created their own Breakout clones, which we covered in our Blaster Master episode. Now, in the 1970s, IBM teamed up with Nanao Corporation and began the production of CRT monitors for their arcade machines that they were putting out.
Now, the company would finally release their arcade game in 1978 called IBM Invader, which you could probably guess was a clone of Space Invaders and probably the most unoriginal name for a game. Like, it'd be literally if we had a company named, like, IBM, and then we made a game that was a ripoff of another game and just put our name on it. They would then change their name the next year to IRIM, as they got a letter reportedly from IBM stating that IBM was too close, and IRIM would stand for International Rental Electronics Machines. So then, IRIM had a game they released called IBM Invader, and now IBM meant nothing. And in the 1980s, Tsujimoto would go on to start the company IRM Corporation, which later became Capcom. Hey, that's why the guy is familiar. Tsujimoto would remain the chairman of IRM during this time, and Nanao Corporation would become the majority shareholder. Tsujimoto, however, would be removed as the chairperson due to poor sales, and he would go on to fully establish Capcom as its own company. In 1986, IRM began their work on their next game for the arcade, Katsuketsu Yanchamaru. Literally, the wonderful Yanchamaru, or as we know in America, Kid Nikki, Radical Ninja. Because, yeah, that's probably what it translates it to.
No, that's not what it translates to. It literally translates to the wonderful Yanchamaru.
Nice. What does Yanchamaru translate to?
That's a name.
So it goes from the wonderful Yanchamaru to Kid Nikki, Radical Ninja.
Yes.
It's better than IBM Invaders.
That's true.
Now, the game would be developed for the IRM 62 arcade system. This board had previously been used on IRM's game Kung Fu Master. It featured a Z80 CPU, which clocked in at 4 MHz, and a M6803 dedicated sound CPU, along with four sound chips, two of which were the AY38910s and two MSM5205s. The board could be configured using jumpers, which would also open up different ROM and RAM capabilities. Now, the year after its release in the arcades, the game would get a port to the NES, Commodore 64, and the Apple II, and these ports would go on to be published by Data East. The American version of Kid Nikki Radical Ninja was slightly different from the Japanese version, but overall, there weren't many significant changes to the game itself. The main difference is, obviously, in the name, which was changed from the wonderful Yanchamaru to Kid Nikki. Another difference would be in the design for the main character. In the American version, his hair is spiked and a bit unruly. In the Japanese version, his hair is tighter and kept in a shamage, which is a traditional Japanese topknot that is typically associated with men in the Edo period, specifically samurai. Though you may see it worn on a modern sumo wrestler. So the game was pretty much the same, except some minor tweaks.
Now, in terms of the plot of the game, it takes place in feudal Japan, which is a very broad way to say between the years of 1185 AD and 1603 AD, which is like 500 years. Feudal Japan is a pretty broad period of time for a game to take place. This time period of Japan was when much of the country was broken into a feudalistic architecture, typically with military leaders known as shoguns having control over most of the country. While the emperor was the one who appointed the shoguns ultimately had more control than the emperor and would hand out land to loyal followers. These landowners would be called daimyos. In order for the daimyo to protect themselves, they employed samurai by paying them in land. If the master of the samurai died and that samurai's contract was not passed to a new master, that samurai may become a ronin. In the game, you play as a ninja, who were usually hired by daimyos as covert agents. Anyway, Kid Nikki is the most radical of all the ninjas. In the game, you learn that your girlfriend, Princess Margot, who may in fact be the daughter of a shogun, but I don't know if that's ever established. Anyway, she gets kidnapped by the stone wizard, and you have to go and save her. It's pretty simple simple game because it's an arcade game. So arcade games don't have complex plots.
Is he a wizard made of stone, or is he just like his, is that like his order that he belongs to?
Well, he's definitely not made of stone. He's like a
stone magic.
No, he shoots fireballs at you.
So he's just like, he's just known as the stone wizard.
Yeah, I guess he's just known as the stone wizard.
Maybe he's the stone wizard.
He's this like, maybe. He's this like really big sprite with like kabuki makeup on. He has white hair and he wears like red silk, like a red silk outfit. And he has like a sumo stance, like his legs are separated.
Oh, nice. Maybe he's just also high.
Maybe. The game is played as a side-scrolling action game. There is some platforming in the later levels, but primarily the gameplay consists of you moving from the left to the right and fighting off guys who come at you from both sides. It is in many ways similar to Kung Fu Master, also by Irem, in that the enemies will just keep on coming at you. They literally, like, do not stop. At the end of the level, you will encounter a boss who you have to defeat. From there, you move on to the next level. Your primary weapon is a blade that you spin around in front of you, and this can pretty much just wipe out enemies right away. Like if they're one hit kills, the enemies go flying away. But when you fight certain bosses, the blade will bounce off of them, so you have to go and pick it up. That's kind of a unique little gameplay element.
Now, while exact sales figures could be sourced, the game initially received a rather lackluster review in a 1988 issue of Computer Gaming World, who called the game yet another seemingly endless parade of horizontally scrolling, running, jumping, shooting games. More recent reviews have been more positive, such as a review in 2018, which, to be fair, I would say a 1988 review of a game that came out back then is probably more relevant to the sales of the game versus a 2018 review. But anyway, a more recent review has been more positive. A 2018 review of the game from NintendoLife.com noted that despite the fact that the game is only 8 levels, it is still enjoyable. The review also noted that the game is challenging but satisfying and gave the game a 7 out of 10. A review from GameSpot was a bit more critical, noting that it is functional and isn't gravely offensive, and recommended it for Nintendo completionists and rated the game as a 6 out of 10. ClassicGames.net gave the game a 7 out of 10 and said that while the game is not a lost classic, it is above average.
I do like the review of the person who said it isn't gravely offensive. I want that on my tombstone. I want my tombstone to say, Zachary Pierce, rest in peace. He was not gravely offensive.
No, on your grave, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, that'd be funny.
I didn't know if you knew the pun was there.
I didn't. Now I do, though. In terms of its legacy, 2 sequels would be made for the Famicom. Keiketsu Yanchimura 2, Kakuri Land, in 1991, and Keiketsu Yanchimura 3, in 1993. These games both feature redesigned versions of Kid Nicky, though he's still the same character. They just have different art for all 3 games. And the gameplay has also changed a bit more to be more platform-based. Specifically, in Keiketsu Yanchimura 3, Kid Nicky can do this thing where you could take, like, a staff, and you can, like, prop it up on a wall, and then you could flip your over, and it's really cool. Another sequel was released called Ganso! ! Yanchimura, which came out for the Game Boy in 1991. The sequels would only be released in Japan, and the third game would ultimately be the last game of the Kid Nicky series. Now, I'm going to dive into some speculation about the legacy. This is my personal speculation when I was thinking about Kid Nicky. I would not be surprised if the other games weren't brought over due to them being rather late releases in the NES life. At this point, sales I don't think mattered too much to Nintendo when it came to whether or not they were going to bring over like a Famicom game and get it translated. But if you think about when the first Kid Nicky came out back in 1988, that's great. But then the second one didn't come out until 1990. And the SNES was already out in 1991. And whilst Nintendo was still putting out some games for the NES and bringing some of those games to the American market, I think there was still a major shift happening in terms of going into the 16-bit market. Also, the Kid Nicky games are very heavily themed in Japanese art and mythology, making them a possible risk when it came to localization, as Irem may have felt that too much work would have to gone into localizing the games for a console that was on its way out the door. If you look at Nintendo's late releases for the United States, it's games like Wario's Woods, Mario's Time Machine, The Jungle Book, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters. These are all games that are pretty much established IPs or did not require localization. And a lot of the late stage Famicom games would not be localized, these being games like Crayon Shin-chan, Ora to Poi Poi, Puyo Puyo, or Dragon Ball Z Gaiden. So again, this is my theorizing. I don't have any data or information to back this up, but my guess is the reason we never saw Kid Nicky 2 and Kid Nicky Mickey 3 come to the American market was likely just because it wasn't an IP that Nintendo cared about. And the SNES was out, and Nintendo really was only thinking about bringing over games that were relevant to their IP for the older consoles, or games that they knew could sell for the older consoles, and focusing their attention on bringing over stuff for the Super Nintendo. Which is why, like, Wario's Woods would have come out, because that's an IP that Nintendo can bank on making money. It's a Mario game. People are going to buy a Mario game. And when you have a dying system in its late stages, you do need some type of IP to be able to keep on getting people to buy it if they're not yet picking up the Super Nintendo. So that's just my theorizing.
Reviews aside from at that time, the game still looks really great.
Oh yeah, it's a good game.
It is a solid game. It's got some really, really good music throughout it. The game is very smooth. I also like Kid Nicky came out during a time when there was still like tracking like scores and stuff like that. Kid Nicky plays in like a window because it came from the arcade and there's scores. Right, you want scores in an arcade game because you want to drive people to play the arcade game to beat the score. But then I also like that when you brought arcade games to the home market, these arcade games came with the scores.
Yeah.
And you could be like an only kid and you're just like, what, just showing off to your friends coming over? Regardless, I think it's still like a really cool kind of hanger honor from the arcade days, where there are scores built in to be able to really drive home the point of competition, because you really just want, the arcade owners wanted people to play games over and over again and spend quarters on them. I also really like with Kid Nicky, he's got like the Z2 text, which I think is just the Nintendo text. And it like gives you a little thank you after when you beat the final boss, where it was just like, just saying that you're just a radical dude. Like, it's like, thanks for being a radical dude, and gives you a little thank you. I don't think games do that enough anymore. They don't write you little personal thank you letters.
No, it's great. I think it's a solid game for the Nintendo. One of my other favorite little details about it is when you defeat a boss, a little message pops up that says, attaboy. It's just like, I love that. That's silly. Like, we need more games doing stuff like that. And I think there's kind of, Kid Nicky to me feels like the perfect type of arcade game, right? The perfect game that you would rent for a weekend, have a blast playing it, and maybe tell your friends that you played it and had a good time sort of deal.
I do want to talk about one particular thing, though. And there is a level where you do get eaten by a fish thing. There's like a Loch Ness monster creature, and you're like crossing the water and you're jumping, and you could get eaten by this water creature. And in order for you to get back to the level, you need to crawl through this creature's stomach, and his butt is a pipe.
Yeah, and you go through the pipe.
Which, this is the NES era. All the characters are going through pipes. I just think that it's funny that there's this, like, creature that is just, like, it eats you. The creature is gigantic in the level, but not in the level that you're fighting it. And you're fighting it, it's a very small creature. It's, like, the same size as you. But then when you get eaten by it, it is the entire level is the size of the creature. So either Kid Nicky got very small or the creature got very large. And then you have to go through his pipe butt to be able to escape the creature, which I just think that's wild. I think that's just a fun decision on, like, we got these pipe sprites that we just put through, or didn't want to really draw creatures.
I'm kind of happy that we didn't get like an NES stylized rectum, but I guess a pipe is appropriate, right?
A pipe is an option.
Now, Kid Nicky also appears in the game Kicklecubicle for the NES, also by Irem, so that might explain why Kid Nicky shows up. Fun fact, if you're playing Kicklecubicle, if the player holds down the A button on controller 2 and then turns the game on, Kid Nicky will be there. Just a fun little Easter egg. Now, Kaketsu Yanchimaru 3 would also show up in the world of bootlegs, thanks to a version of the game called Super Mario 14 that replaces Kid Nicky's head with Mario's head. Though sometimes Kid Nicky's head appears when they forgot to put Mario's head there. So you're really just playing Kid Nicky 3, but sometimes Mario is there. The game also replaces some of the enemies with Koopas and Spinies from Super Mario Brothers, and some of the items have been replaced with Mario mushrooms and coins. Another Kid Nicky game would also get the pirate treatment, specifically Kaiketsu Yanchimaru 2 Kakuri Land, which was hacked into Super Mario Brothers 16. Unlike other similar bootleg ROM hacks, this game actually features a custom-drawn Mario sprite, which is kind of unique, that replaces the Kid Nicky sprite. And the game was made easier, as the pirates give you 10 lives when you play the game, as opposed to the normal 3. Now, Kid Nicky Radical Ninja would be brought to the Switch as part of the Arcade Archives, and 2018. The Arcade Archives have a whole bunch of different arcade games, but you can get a Kid Nicky Radical Ninja Arcade Archives release on your Switch if you want to play it. And that will be our Kid Nicky episode. So I want to thank David for the recommendation. And David, if you liked this episode, let us know. And if you hate this episode, keep it a secret. Or you can let us know. You can tell us. Now, getting into our retro rewind, Seth had me play Star Wars Episode 1 Racer. Released in 1999 by LucasArts, Racer is a fast-paced racing game that puts you behind the controls of a pod racer from the Star Wars films. It's great. The game plays like other racing games from the era, with the difference being that pod racers go super duper fast. They go so fast, the speedometer sometimes clocks out. The speedometer, which they have at the bottom of the screen, will be like exceeding 600, 700 miles per hour. I think it's miles per hour. I don't know. It could be space distance. But it's a fun game. You do these circuit races. So it's not like a kart racer. They're circuit races of you go in, you know, in a big circuit, and you have other pod racers that you have to beat. Because it's also pod racing, you encounter various like hazards. Like in Tatooine, you get shot at by Tusken Raiders, and you can crash your pod racer and it will explode. Now, you have the choice of playing as various pod racers. Some of these include Sebulba, Anakin Skywalker, Gascano, Odie Mandrail, and a bunch of other people I never heard of. I don't even think they're mentioned in the movies. Gascano and Odie Mandrail are characters in the movies, but some of the other players are not.
Those are the best Star Wars characters.
They really are. There are a few different circuits you play. There's the amateur circuit, the semi-pro circuit, the galactic circuit, and the invitational circuit. Each circuit also has different worlds from the Star Wars universe. So you can visit Malastare, Tatooine, Ando Prime, and again, a bunch of other places I never even heard of. But I assume there's entire books written about them.
And they're no longer canon.
That's right. It's a good game, despite it being no longer canon. I think it holds up, and there's actually a copy available on Steam if you would rather play it on your computer versus playing it using an N64 controller. But let's be real. The only real way to play it is with an N64 controller. Next week, Seth, I want you to play a game called Magic Sword Heroic Fantasy for the Super Nintendo.
Great. Thank you. Zach had me play Klax for the NES. Klax is a puzzle video game, and apparently Zach likes to give me puzzle video games to play. It was originally developed by Atari Games and published under Atari for arcades and Tengen for consoles, except in Japan, which it was published by Namco. The game has a four-position joystick and a button you control a paddle at the lower end of a conveyor belt. You then have to stack color blocks that essentially walk down the conveyor belt in the same colors, and once you get three stacked up, they disappear like Tetris. It's a fun basic puzzle game, and if you like some good zoning out type puzzle stuff, I think Klax still holds up, except for the reason that I'm going to mention now, and that's the noise that the blocks make as they approach. They make this weird noise. It's like, And I would say we wrote the notes for this episode a little while ago. And so it was a while since I played Klax. I still hear those noises in my bed when I try to go to sleep. So ultimately, I think it's a fine game, but maybe play it on mute as these blocks come forward. Definitely type of game that you would otherwise be playing, maybe Super Breakout or those type of situations. And just because I didn't mention it at the top, Klax came out in 1990. Next week, Zach, you can play the Uncanny X-Men for the NES, which is the first X-Men video game.
Sure.
Not X-Man.
I know, not X-Man. Good old X-Man. Anyway, thanks for listening to the episode. If you have any thoughts on this episode, you can email us at classicgamingbrothers@gmail.com. We're available wherever podcasts can be found, via Podbean, iHeartRadio, or iTunes. We're also available on Facebook, Classic Gaming Brothers, Instagram, Classic Gaming Brothers, XCG Brothers Pod, Blue Sky CG Brothers Pod, or Threads, Classic Gaming Brothers. We're also on YouTube now, so that's cool. Come visit us on YouTube and subscribe. Besides that, Seth, am I forgetting anything?
Don't play games like my brother.
And don't play games like my brother.
I've been Seth.
And I've been Zach.
And we've been the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's
right.
That's right.